Welcome to another edition of Anglican Unscripted. This is episode, I guess we're up to 853 now, George. I'm Kevin Coulson.
I'm George Conger. Today is April 30th, 2024.
All right, well, thank you for joining us for another episode of Anglican Unscripted. We're glad you could be here. This is where George and Kevin, we go to our happy place. First, I don't know why, but we're news freaks. We like to read the news and tell people about the news and kind of decide what the heck is going on out there in the world. And this is what you sit down and listen to, what the heck's going on in the world. We're glad you could join us. Before we get too far into the show, I'm so close to 10,000 subscribers. You could just see it at the top of the hill. We're at 9,600 and so many subscribers. So if you've not subscribed to the show, and there's many of you who have not, 28%, I don't mean to point fingers. If you could click the subscribe button and click that bell that pops up right after that, you'll be instantly notified every time there's a new episode of Anglican Unscripted or whatever else I cover around the world. It's helpful for you and for me that you're subscribed. And if you want to like the show on Facebook and YouTube, that fools the algorithm and tells them it's a good show and that they should promote it. And it's free advertising for George and I. George, how are you doing this week?
Miserable. It's been a tough weekend. I've had a family crisis, necessitated my wife flying out west. She may have to stay out there for a few weeks, maybe a month or longer. Two people die over the weekend at the church, and it's just a number of viewers have criticized me because I will smile when talking about horrible things. They say, oh, you must be taking wicked delight in these things. Yeah. And no, the answer is not that. It's just that, you know, when these bad things happen, and for long-term viewers of our show, you've walked with us through difficult times, illnesses and deaths and family and whatnot, there is a peace when you trust in the Lord and just don't let him move out of the center of your being. So I can talk about, you know, wars and famine and conflict and evil and sickness and death, but I can still be at peace.
But even at a personal level, okay, at 10 o'clock today, Jill and I got very devastating news, but I'm still here to report because I need to be anxious and nothing. And I really take that to heart. You know, I remember the days when I was anxious, like watching Gulf War I on CNN. I'm just like, oh, just fearful and anxious and all that buildup. Or I remember what it was like to be anxious and not take to heart, you know, that God is in control. That at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, he is in control. And any time that I'm anxious, it's because I don't believe he's in control. And that's me taking over that. And I believe fully that God is in control. I may not like or feel comfortable with what happens, but I like who's doing it. I follow, you know, to death the God and the Trinity who I've chosen to follow. And I don't see any reason after all my years of experience to change that now. Boom. You know, that's the way it is. Let's move on, George, to the news. I'm keeping on a different page here. Here we go. So news is out there. We talked about the primates going to Rome. It was the headline of last week's show. And a group photo of the event shows that 30 primates out of the 42 are there. And they get to do some special things, meet the Pope, you know, they probably get a free rosary, that type of thing. But good to see that the primates are having a meeting, George.
Yeah, and it's, there's been a lot of speculation in the church press about this as a make-or-break meeting. One phrase was high-stakes poker is being played. And I have to tell you, friends, that's not happening. This is being billed as a pilgrimage and a time of prayer for the primates who are there. There are about 41, 42 primates. I think one or two offices are vacant. 10, 11, 12 people are missing. Michael Curry's sick, but he has a substitute there. The GAFCON primates are not there. The Global South primates, some are, some aren't. And so about a quarter have stayed away. And this is about this proportion that have stayed away for the past few meetings. So that there's no breakthrough. There's no gain of people. There's no loss of people. There's seven new boys who don't know. And basically, they don't know anything about how these things work.
Which one's Justin? Which one's Justin? Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Well, but you know, it's exciting because, you know, they're going to Rome. They're going to meet the Pope. This is a junket. And is anything substantive going to come out of this? Well, there have been reports that the Inter-Anglican UFO Commission, Unity, Faith, and Order, unfortunately named UFO Commission.
No, I think it's properly named.
is going to present a first draft of their plans for the reorganizing of the instruments of the Anglican world. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's been the push by the Global South to remove Canterbury from the center of the circle. And it's agreed that perhaps we need to change the way things are done. But they're pushing like a 6 to 8 year bureaucratic, process. That's not acceptable to the Global South or GAFCON. But so it's going to be under discussion. But basically, I have very low expectations other than that I hope the fellows have a great time on their vacation. But there's not going to be any true, I hope I'm surprised.
No, but
there's not going to be some breakthrough of any sort.
They tried that. They tried to have meetings. They tried to hold other provinces accountable. Jill, George, I called you my wife's name, George. We're practically married. And so they tried that over the last 12 years. It didn't work. It didn't work, not because they didn't try, but because the Archbishop of Canterbury thwarted the process. He, you know, basically sunk that ship. They agreed in London when they had a primates gathering that they're going to hold the Episcopal Church accountable for 3 years. And Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, said, "You guys don't worry about enforcing that. I'll take care of it." Months later, we see Michael Curry officiating the wedding of Harry and Meghan, talking to us about love, true love. It was one of those type of weddings. And in a sense, you're like, wait a minute. So we've been hoodwinked here. You know, this Justin fellow lies. Not only does he, you know, not hold people accountable, he will lie and tell you he will. And so, in as such, I don't think we can have another honest primates meeting with this primus, George.
Also, even before with Rowan Williams, there was the meeting in Tanzania where Rowan Williams was charged by the primates to go to the Episcopal General Convention and tell them off, don't do the gay stuff anymore, you got to stop. And Rowan Williams punted.
You know, he flew to New Orleans. He went there and he got talked out of it.
Wasn't very hard to talk him out of.
No.
But so these expectations of great clashes of wills and whatnot, This is not how the primates meeting work. They're bureaucratically controlled junkets where the agenda is written ahead of time and the closing statement is written ahead of time. So we really shouldn't expect anything profound. Now, I'm hoping that the Global South meeting in June outside of Cairo will take a different course. But are we still... I don't really have a sense yet of whether there's momentum on the Global South side, but there certainly is inertia and stasis on the Welby side.
And I think, Justin Welby is trying to get the band back together, but he brings them in castrated. We're bringing the band back together. You can be primates, but don't bring your instruments. Don't be who primates are. Don't be teachers of the church. Don't be leaders of the church. We're just going to get together and we're going to go meet the Pope. And have some tea, and here's your free rosaries. Yeah,
and also these meetings really, they're not proper. For instance, Justin Welby always has been inviting Stephen Cottrell, the Archbishop of York, to come to these meetings to be a primate. well, he's the primate of England, while Justin Welby's the primate of all England. Well, if that's the case, then why don't we have the Archbishop of Dublin and the Archbishop of Armagh, the primate of Ireland and the primate of all Ireland? Or why don't we have five Nigerian archbishops or the five Canadian provincial archbishops? But instead, Justin Welby gets to add a buddy with the same voice and vote and authority as the leader of a very large church whose Inga gets two votes, for instance. Or loyalty is rewarded. The Archbishop of Mexico, who was deposed by the Mexican General Synod, whom a court, civil court, has upheld the validity of that deposition, and it's gone through the appeals process and it's been fully adjudicated, the guy's out, Archbishop Trevino is no longer the Archbishop of Mexico, he still has an invitation from Justin Welby because he is a loyalist. He is a brown face that will say good things about Welby and the English system. Now, that's very cynical on my part, but, you know, this is how it's working.
Let's work that way for a long time, and we'll talk more about archbishops and their past decisions as we get further into our stories. Let me move on to our next story. I'm glad they could get together in Rome, and I hope that God can be glorified in that, not just with a picture. Okay, you sent me the notes again today. Notes number two is Watch Conference held at St. John's Waterloo in London on April 20th. And, yep, here's where I get to talk about Archbishop George Carey. But we'll do that when we get through the story. What's the story, George?
Well, there was a gathering of batshit crazy women. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, every group in the world has their extremists, you know.
Women in the Church, WATCH is the acronym, is a lobbying group that wants to promote women clergy. And they had, their main speaker was Rose Hudson Wilkin, who is the Bishop of Dover, who's a bit of a character and a bit of an extremist.
Yes.
And the Rose Hudson Wilkin basically said, okay, it's been 10 years since the five guiding principles of the Church of England were adopted, which is the mutual flourishing, live and let live.
Mm-hmm.
She says, it's time to end that.
Yeah.
It's time to mandate that
Wait,
all.
Wait, did she use the word? Did she use the word mandate? She's maybe.
You didn't say mandate. Okay, it's time to require that all clergy accept the ministry of women priests and bishops. To junk the five guiding principles, that there be no allowance to do what the Church of Sweden did.
Yeah.
Church of Sweden went through a process of first permitting women priests, then mandating women priests. And now if you don't believe in women clergy or gay clergy, you cannot even be ordained. The Watch wants the Church of England to follow that path, to move from what was optional to what is mandatory. And to me, this sort of speaks of weakness, to be frank. Since 2014, the Church of England's blob, the hierarchy, has managed to keep out all conservative new bishops, one or two exceptions, but certainly no new conservative evangelical bishops. Philip North became bishop after having been a suffragan or an area bishop. But he went through such blood pain and bloodletting that, you know, I don't think people are going to put themselves up for it again. So the Watch group and their allies have been able to cull conservative bishops. They've not been able to do it with conservative clergy. Conservative clergy, by and large, are doing well. We've not had a mass defection yet. We've had some people leave, but they're still there. And those people are an offense to the Rose Hudson Wilkin group. Partially because many of them are very successful in their ministries. The churches, all the statistics we've reported on the past, the churches that have women, I'm sorry, that have children in them are conservative evangelical. The churches that are growing and all this and that. Whereas the Watch constituency is dying. on the is not able to reproduce itself. And watches out of weakness, I think, is now demanding action rather than seeking to persuade. The Gamaliel test, they've failed. And so now they want to compel adherence to their worldview.
Short history. Who was the Archbishop of Canterbury who first voted for women clergy in the Church of England, George?
Oh, that was George Carey.
He's still out there. He's still healthy. He can still write a little blog and opinion or do an interview with Anglican Skeptic. I would be interested in his opinion of this. I would even, Justin Welby, who said we can have women bishops. What's your opinion on this? Yeah, I thought mutual flourishing was something that would be mutual beneficial to both sides of an issue. We are now to the point where we can only have one issue, and one issue only, we can have the unbiblical issue. So, okay. Yeah.
I haven't spoken to George Carey lately, but I do know that George Carey does believe in women's orders, but he also believes in mutual flourishing. He believes in the setup that they had 30 years ago, that you can permit this. This is a second order issue, but you should not mandate one or the other. Justin Welby is famous or infamous for speaking to groups and telling them what they want to hear. So when he speaks to gay activists outside of the palace, the gates of Lambeth Palace, he'll say one thing and he'll say another thing to the primates at the primates meeting. So Welby has been caught out in being two-faced so often that, I'll leave it there.
That's a good place to leave it. All right, so we cover all that, and maybe we can hear from former Archbishop.
I think your question is, was George Carey naive in thinking that an accommodation could be reached? Well, if the accommodation was just with people of his generation, if you will, World War II and after generation, there was still a residual degree of toleration and respect for different opinions. But the polarization of the last 20, 30 years has basically rendered that absent. You know, look at the way our own governments operate. Used to be a little more bipartisanship, but now that's just a thing of the past.
Yeah, I don't know if they had respect for each other, but at the end of the day, they could eat together in politics. You know, Roland Williams and Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill were a good example. You know, they hated each other's politics, but at the end of the day, they could have a cup of tea and have a steak together. And those days are over, you know. So let's move on to story number three. The Church of England announces a plan to pay compensation and damages to sexual abuse victims. The payouts, surprisingly, are going to range from £5,000 to £660 based on length of time of abuse. I'm not understanding this, George. We have taken the ability of the church to apologize and to ask for forgiveness and to have these people participate in that to, you're now a mathematical equation, let's pay you out.
The Church of England has put out a four-stage redress scheme that has payout on the low end of 5,000 to the high end of £660,000. And they're basically going to be a formula for determining where one falls on this four-stage level of, you know, degree of abuse, length of abuse, so on and so forth. I mean, it's not unreasonable. It's sort of an insurance mindset, you know, paying, you know, if you have an industrial accident, you get more if you lose an arm than if you lose a hand, sort of thing. So it's a positive step forward that they're starting now to put their money where their mouth is. I mean, you could say that, well, they can come up with £100 million for imaginary reparations, but now they'll come up with £5,000 for a child who was raped by a priest. But what they've not come up with is any structural changes to ensure that there's accountability for the leaders who covered up or ignored or demonized those who reported victimization.
But as we reported, those people are currently those people are currently in charge.
Mm-hmm. So it's a good step because compensation for damages is a just thing. To be perfectly honest, from an American perspective, $5,000 to $660,000 is peanuts.
Yeah. Well, let's do the math conversion here. If 50,000, that's 62,000 US dollars. So 5,000 would be $6,200. That's not very much if I were abused by a priest.
That's, but, England has doesn't have the legal system we have here and damages and this and that. But they're willing to throw money into a problem, but they're not willing to put themselves or their souls or the truth into the problem.
Yeah.
I was trying to mention that how many years it's been since Justin Welby promised to meet with the John Smythe or the victims, or how much cover up do we have with the Jonathan Fletcher business and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And they've asked to meet with him, and he said he would meet with them. It just never occurs. It's something that just, if we could have like a running calendar, how many days since Justin Welby said he would meet with the victims? And we're up to at least 800 days, 900 days? And the clock keeps ticking, if not more.
Where Johnson Tamu is disciplined when he's retired as Archbishop of York, he loses his license to officiate in the Diocese of Newcastle in the north because he had knowledge but took no action on abuse, whereas the bishop who actually didn't do anything and who was the frontline bishop, Stephen Croft of Oxford, who is now Oxford, is left untouched. Stephen Cottrell, when he was Bishop of Reading, was involved in some of this stuff, and of course it doesn't stick to him because he's still in office, he's still a person of consequence. But, they can beat up on dead people. They can beat up on retired people. George Bell, George Carey, Johnson Tamu. But they will not, but those who are actually responsible will not stand and take the justice to be meted out to them.
Yeah. All right. So our next story, I'm going to let people guess the location of the story. But how many, we got 40 provinces in?
41, 42.
Well, counting the ACNA, 42. So we have 42 provinces out there. One province has such bad, and this may give it away, corruption, that the court has appointed a trustee to oversee all the accounts of this province. And I think this is kind of the first time I've ever heard of this happening, in a communion province-wide church. And it makes news in the middle of our story structure because it's so important. Because of people who want to have relationships with this type of province because they would have access to such a large proportion of future Christians, George. Who am I talking about?
Oh, Church of South India. Oh, my. A high court in Madras, or Chennai, has placed the assets of the Church of South India under the control of a court-appointed trustee or receiver because the corruption of the leadership, the bishops and the elected leaders, is so bad that they have been basically pillaging the assets of the Church of South India. And a number of lay groups have filed lawsuits trying to get it cleaned up. And every time they clean up this little diocese, then this happens in this next little diocese. Now, not every bishop is dirty, but the majority are. At one time, a majority of the bishops were under criminal investigation. The primate is under criminal investigation for fraud. The Church of North India, different church, same country, is in jail right now for fraud. And he's been defrocked and deposed. And the courts in India have basically said, look, you guys cannot be trusted with your property because we've had too many bishops and too many diocesan executive committee selling off church assets at fire sale prices to developers from whom they get kickbacks. So it's, you know, corruption is such a major problem in the Indian church that, you know, what can one say?
And what can one do? I mean, as a Anglican communion, how can we help restructure and reformulate and hold accountable those, instead of having them show up for pictures and stuff as we have junkets around the world? I'm just trying to think outside the box here, George.
Well, at the end of the day, to be perfectly honest, the whole corruption is more of an issue in Tanzania and in some of the African provinces, in Zimbabwe, for instance, in India and other places, South America, Mexico.
Well, that's because corruption still is led at the state level. In India, they're trying to correct the corruption, and the corruption here is at the church level.
But, you know, like in Mexico, the corruption, the government's corrupt, and the church has an opportunity to stand for truth and for the people, but instead the system there has been that a number of, not all the Mexican bishops, far from it, some have led the drive against corruption. That's why the primate Trevino was kicked out. But if the Anglican Communion's leaders, if they paid attention to corruption as an issue of importance, rather than putting gay stuff front and center on every issue, I think it would do more for the daily life of so many of the Christians in this world if they focused on corruption and bad government, both in the church and in the world, than on, you know, our next story is about the latest insanity of the Episcopal Church. You know, that being the issue.
Yeah. Well, I've spoken often that the church has lost the benefit of the doubt. And this is one of the reasons. You won't hold your own people accountable. You won't hold your bishops and clergy accountable. We can see the corruption. We can see how a priest becomes ordained and gains a parish one day, and a year later he's driving a Land Rover. We see that corruption, and you guys won't do anything about it. And why would we trust you? And it's true. Why are we focusing on the gay issue when the corruption issue is 1,000 times more hurtful to the church? A million times more hurtful. So, yeah, good point there, George. Let's move on to our next story here.
The situation in India is such that clergy pay other clergy to allow to be for their votes at synods,
yeah,
so that they can become bishop, with the expectation that they can recoup their investment out of the coffers of the diocese and out of the Christians in the diocese. That's how bad it is in India.
And that happens in India and in Africa. It's not mutually exclusive to any one place there. Rico Tice leaves the Church of England, kind of. He is a John Stott prodigy. He spent 28 years at All Souls Langdon Place, and he's been the author of Christianity Explored course, and he was last year's speaker at GAFCON in Kigali. And to me, it's kind of just like another guy who go, wait, what? There's corruption? How dare there be gambling here in Casablanca? It's like you kind of woke up to it when it's been going on all around. And I take this to people who are optimists like myself and pessimists. When I see a situation like the Church of England, I see opportunity. If we can just shine the light bright enough, they will come to their senses. And guess what? That doesn't always happen. In fact, in the Church of England, it seldom happens. And that seldom happened to Rico Tice, George.
Well, in a successful church, and if you sit at the feet of John Stott, and if you're involved in successful ministries, you can get the impression that, you know, yeah, it may be bad down the street, but God is doing great things. Mm-hmm. Rico gave an interview with Evangelicals Now where he admitted to being naive about the state of affairs in the Church of England, thinking that the success that he experienced and the fellowship and the Christian enthusiasm that was so infectious and so much of his ministry and life was shared by other people. And that, you know, when the Archbishop of Canterbury asked him to be on a commission to help evangelize England, he meant it, rather than just, you know, oh, well, we need somebody from column A and somebody from column B. Well, Weaker retired after 28 years at All Souls Langham Place. He still works and manages Christianity Explored, which is akin to the Alpha program. Mm-hmm. It's a small group, a leadership course. But he told Evangelicals Now that he's now worshiping at an independent Presbyterian church because he cannot stomach the apostasy of the leadership of the Church of England. Now, this is a big deal because, you know, John Stott was famous with his debates for J.I. Packer in the 60s and 70s of, do we stay in and work from within to reform it, or do we break out and go our own ways?
Yeah, where can we do the most good, inside or outside?
Yeah, Stott and Packer, to a lesser extent, basically said staying content. Well, here is one of Stott's great acolytes who basically said staying and contending isn't worth it anymore, which is quite a statement.
Indeed. All right. But hold on. You have even noticed he's keeping his license to officiate. Why would he do that?
Yeah, we had an Anglican Ink story by Julian Mann where even though he's worshiping at a Presbyterian church and has left the Church of England, he's still keeping his license from the Diocese of London, a PTO, permission to officiate, mm-hmm. which will allow him to be a guest preacher and celebrant at London diocesan churches. So the question is he all the way in or all the way out, or is he half in, half out, or is he out this Sunday but in next Sunday? And the Diocese of London has decided not to answer that question, and Rico Tice hasn't either.
Huh? Well, let's just hope he's not guilty by association like George Carey and loses his license like the former Archbishop did for a time. All right, let's move on to some of the last stories we have here. The Nashota House, a famous, very famous seminary in Wisconsin, has appointed a new dean, Laura Whitna. I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. Now, in the history of Nashota House, I don't remember them having a female dean, not a big deal. I do not remember them having a lay person as dean. And I thought, hey, well, let's talk about stuff here, George. First of all, congratulations.
Yeah, I know nothing about her. No. I don't know nothing about her. I looked at her resume and mm-hmm. Didn't really tell me much of anything. And I'm just wondering, what was the board of Nashota House looking for? Were they looking to have somebody who could be acceptable both to the Episcopal Church and the ACNA? Were they looking to basically to move in one direction, to be fully in the Episcopal world or fully in the ACNA world? I can't tell.
Well, that was a good question. Just looking back at recent history, as far as my history, Robert Munday was the dean there for a while. Then he was let go, and they replaced him with a former bishop of South Carolina to be an interim dean there. It shows that, it's clearly Munday was pure ACNA or pro-ACNA, and the bishop, Ed Salmon was pro-tech. Are they just going back and forth, or?
Well, Woody Garfield, who stepped down as dean, he's still going to be there as a professor. Mm-hmm. He was able to sort of thread the needle. And
he did a good job, yeah.
Tech and ACNA. Mm-hmm. And probably the stress of doing that was something that, he wasn't worth the grief. So is this young woman, and she's in her late 30s, early 40s, is she going to be up to it? It's an interesting choice.
It is. Well, you and I love Nashota House. We did a one-day course there a year or two ago, and that was a lot of fun. So We pray for the seminaries that they bring up righteous young leaders for the Episcopal Church and for the ACNA and for denominations around the world, Lutherans included. So we shall see what happens there, but congratulations and Godspeed to Lauren. A lot of our audience doesn't know what DEI is, George. Some people said they'd look it up. DEI is what?
Diversity, equity, inclusion.
Yes.
That's the moniker for the current wokeness fad of affirmative action and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Basically, if your company has gone woke and you understand that all white men are bad or potentially bad, you want to make amends to that, and you hire a DEI officer who can help guide the way with hiring people and training people and training them to know what is good and bad in a new light, not with scripture or morality, but in light of wokeness, and how these people can advance themselves over other people based on their minority status. And it looks like Tech hired a gender staff officer. I will put their picture here for you, so you can see their higher picture. And George, without us getting sued, anything you want to say? You used the word allegedly in front of. What's your thoughts? Allegedly.
It just goes to show the priorities of the Episcopal Church's leadership. Money is very tight. We have dioceses amalgamating, dioceses unable to afford bishops, Diocese of New Jersey asking for a $200,000 cut in their payout for this year because of problems with their accounting. Yet money can be found to hire somebody to try to support gay and lesbian ministries in the Episcopal Church. I mean, it's a caricature. And the fellow, I'm sure he's good at his job. He is a graduate of Union Theological Seminary and has had a bunch of committee type jobs that actually don't deal with sort of normal parishioner life, but, you know, have been focused on specific niche markets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just the ridiculousness of how they spend their money. It's like the Church of England Diocese, was it Bradford, spending all this money to hire somebody to combat whiteness, when in the North of England's a pretty white place. And, you know, the Episcopal Church, we need to get more gay people. Which gay people are left to be gotten by the Episcopal Church? I mean, come on now.
You got them all. Well, I'm going to include a little story here that's related to this. And there's a little track event happening in West Virginia that involved some middle school girls and one transgender girl, a boy who thought he was a girl. And the girls decided, hey, you know, he's throwing 3 feet farther than us. We're not going to compete against this man who's pretending to be a girl. And so we're walking away from the competition. And the school board, and now the state, has decided that these girls are no longer allowed to compete at any level in the state for not being forced to play with this boy. And that's just the new normal here. What, 120 years of feminism has just been blown out of the water completely by transgenderism. You know, women have no rights. Little girls have no rights. They don't have the right not to say no to this athletic rape. You have to accept it. Men will always be better, and now you know. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Except in Florida.
Oh, yeah.
The governor has said that these Title IX regulations put down by the Biden administration, which interprets women under the Title IX Department of Education rules to include people who think they're women but biologically are men, Florida will not allow that or enforce that or permit that in its school systems. So the states can, if they so choose, push back.
Well, I think you and I and Christians and people of reason need to really start pushing back. This is gender appropriation. This gender has been stolen. The person using it did not do anything to earn it. They are not the gender they claim to be, and they are hurting other people of that gender. They're raping the gender that they're saying they are, because now they're forcing women to play with men, and that's the new rape, because the girls are not allowed to say no. Yeah, it's crazy. I know. Oh my, is right. Okay, let's move on to our last story. New bishop for English Ordinariate. Well, this is interesting. David Waller, 62, served as the Church of England priest for 20 years and was a member of the General Synod before becoming a Catholic priest in 2011. He's the new lead, George.
Yes, the Ordinariate is led by Monsignor Keith Newton. 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And Newton's married, and so even though he's a bishop in the Church of England, he could not be a Catholic bishop because he has a wife. And that was the same with Jeffrey Steenson in the United States. And so these men, as leaders of the ordinariates in England and the U.S., Canada, were given the rank of Monsignor and apostolic visitors for the diocese. They held the authority of a bishop, but they weren't given the title of the bishop. Waller's unmarried, and because of that, he will be ordained a bishop and will be the first ordained priest ordained to the episcopate by the ordinariate in this current system. So the ordinariate, it's chugging along. It's not been the success that its founders had hoped, but it is not withered up and drunk gone away.
All right, that's the last of our stories, George. George and I now have to leave the program and go handle the stuff that we're not anxious about, that's out of the world. Keep us in your prayers, because not only as anchors and co-host of the show, it puts us in the spotlight where Satan loves to attack us through our families. And there's nothing that will get Kevin more off the beaten path than having to deal with a child or a family emergency. Same with George. We love our families. And if you could spend today just a couple minutes at the end of the show here just praying for us and lifting us up and lifting us up the ministry of Anglican Unscripted, we would greatly appreciate that, because we want to be here for you tomorrow and for many years to come. I'm Kevin Coulson.
I'm George Conger, and you've been watching episode 853 of Anglican Unscripted.